Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 20th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing civil asset forfeiture. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and, as always, our call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call two experts on civil asset forfeiture. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them, about 5 to 10 minutes or so. We'll hear first from Mr. Andrew R. Kloster, Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Legal Center at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. We'll hear next from Ms. Darpana Sheth. She's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. And with that, Mr. Kloster, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. So my name is Andrew Kloster. I'm a legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation, and basically I'm here to talk about civil forfeiture. Civil forfeiture or civil asset forfeiture is a type of civil seizure that is little known and little understood in our legal system. Under state and federal law, the government can permanently seize property that is suspected of involvement in criminal activity. Not just property related to a crime proved beyond a reasonable doubt, that's governed by criminal forfeiture laws. State and federal laws use a variety of low thresholds of proof and opaque administrative schemes to allow state and federal authorities to seize property even of folks with no involvement in crime whatsoever. So why on earth would government do this? Government is here to help. Well, for a variety of reasons, one of which is the perverse incentive of, quote, policing for profit, which Darpana will talk about a bit more. And another is, I think, any stick to beat a dog. Anyways, a few examples I think are important for understanding civil forfeiture. The Washington Times has reported the story of Terry Deco, an immigrant owner of a grocery store who fled to the U.S. to escape religious persecution in Iraq. One day this January, Terry woke up to find that the IRS has seized $35,000, the entirety of his grocery bank accounts. Why? Because he had made a series of cash deposits under $10,000, and the IRS accused Deco of violating so-called structuring laws, willfully making a series of otherwise legal small cash deposits in order to avoid the bank cash deposit reporting requirements. Now, the underlying offense is bad enough, although I suppose it is an attempt to prevent money laundering, but it gets worse. Deco had been audited last year, and the IRS sent him a letter that, quote, no violations were identified in his return. Deco would like nothing better than to tell the IRS, hey, I made small deposits not to avoid reporting requirements, but because my insurance only covers cash loss up to $10,000. So I don't like carrying more than that around. But he's been afforded no opportunity to be heard, and he's forced to sue in federal court. The IRS still has his cash. Here's another example. At Funk Night at the Contemporary Art Institute of Detroit in 2008, a fun night out morphed into a scene out of an action movie. Armor-clad police swarmed the party, forced attendees to the floor, and seized 44 vehicles. Why? The event organizers of the Funk Night had failed to obtain a liquor license, so the Detroit PD imputed guilt to each of the guests and to their property. They even seized a car parked in a friend's driveway over a mile away, and forced each guest to pony up $900 to have his or her car returned. Ultimately, a federal district judge vacated the seizures as violating the Fourth Amendment, but the problem persists even notwithstanding judicial fixing these things at the back end. I could name 100 more cases, and I'm sure Darpana will mention a few more, but suffice it to say that in each of these cases, the government takes property allegedly related to a crime and is generally allowed to keep the property, even if the owner isn't guilty of a crime, and even if the owner has been acquitted of the underlying offense on the merits. This, I contend, is offensive to our constitutional system of government. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the origins of civil forfeiture. The origins of American civil forfeiture law are shrouded in the mist of legal history, but analogs appear as far back as Roman law, and more proximately in 11th century English law. In 1881, future Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Common Law traced the history of that, quote, most primitive notion in law, the liability of inanimate things, suggesting the origins of civil forfeiture might be found in the English law of the deodand. From the Latin Deo Dandum, or given to God, quote, where a man is killed by a cart, or by the fall of a house, or in other like manner, and the thing in motion is the cause of death, it shall be deodand, forfeited to the crown. The point of the deodand, just like the point of civil forfeiture today, is subject to some debate. Why should a tree be forfeited to the state if it falls and kills a citizen? Is it because the tree is cursed? Is it to compensate the state for a loss of the citizen? Does it serve some incentivizing purpose for landowners, or as an expressive purpose for a public that needs someone or something to blame? Whatever the theory, the deodand was abolished in Britain by 1846, and even the very first session of Congress prohibited the forfeiture of estate as a punishment for felons. But forfeiture remained in the background, something I'll talk a bit more about in a minute when I talk about Bennis, a Supreme Court case. For now, flash forward to 1970. In that year, Congress passed the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act and authorized civil forfeiture in the context of the war on drugs. The act allowed the government to seize controlled substances, and in 1978, the act was amended to allow the seizure of drug proceeds. Finally, in 1984, Congress amended the act again to allow seizure of real property that was used or intended to be used to commit or facilitate a drug offense. Title transferred at the moment of the act giving rise to the forfeiture action. So if you bought a property that had been used in a drug deal, the federal government could seize it years later. This really opened up the door to abuse, at least at the federal level, and many good folks in the movement weighed in. In 2000, Congress passed the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act, colloquially known as CAFRA. CAFRA did a good number of things. It mandated certain notice in civil forfeiture actions. It provided court-appointed counsel for those unable to afford counsel in forfeiture proceedings, required warrants for seizures, established preponderance of the evidence as the default standard. Some states, even today, use probable cause as the standard, and created a preference for criminal forfeiture where applicable. It also codified the innocent owner defense, something Darpana will talk about a bit more. I will only talk about the innocent owner defense briefly when I talk about Bennis. At the state level, one major thing to mention is equitable sharing. As civil forfeiture abuses led to state reforms, local police departments were hamstrung. They weren't allowed to keep the profits from civil forfeiture. It had to go back to state general funds. Well, the feds are here to help, and joint FBI, state police, local police actions have the benefit that the feds can share the profits with their state and local partners, notwithstanding state law. So this is generally the statutory context right now. So as a matter of Supreme Court case law, what protections are available for property owners subject to civil forfeiture? Well, it's a sorry line of cases because the most reasonable textual hook for these for rights against civil forfeiture have been written out of the Constitution by the Supreme Court. Civil forfeiture is a taking, right? Folks need to be justly compensated pursuant to the Fifth Amendment, right? Wrong on both counts. Well, what if you're innocent? Surely you have a 14th Amendment due process right not to have your property seized without compensation. Wrong again. These twin principles of anti-due process trace to a 1996 Supreme Court case, Bennis v. Michigan, written by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Tina Bennis jointly owned a car with her husband. Her husband used the car to cheat on her and solicit prostitutes. So, naturally, Tina lost her share in the car. That's sort of how the government sometimes thinks. In 1996, Chief Justice Rehnquist, writing for the majority, upheld the seizure of her share of the car on two grounds. First, the court held that the innocent owner defense does not flow from the 14th Amendment. Now, remember that this defense was codified into federal law in 2000, but of course, this is not the rule in the states. Why doesn't innocence work? Well, Justice Rehnquist reasoned, quote, a long and unbroken line of cases holds that an owner's interest in a property may be forfeited by reason of the use to which the property is put, even though the owner did not know that it was to be put to such use, end quote. Now, I'm a strong supporter of tradition, but it seems odd that the only areas of tradition that ever seem to be upheld are those with a thumb on the scale of government authority. What about the takings claim? Well, this piggybacks on the first point. Quote, the government may not be required to compensate an owner for property that it has already lawfully acquired under the exercise of governmental authority other than the power of eminent domain, end quote. Now, this might make sense if the seizure were temporary and prophylactic or remedial, but there are a number of problems with this that we can discuss in Q&A. So BENA stands for the proposition that the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause and the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause cannot help on the merits. As an aside, United States v. James Daniel Good, real property, stands for the principle that procedural due process safeguards do attach in civil forfeiture proceedings. But you can have all the procedural due process in the world, and of course you don't actually get that, and the underlying merits of the seizure might never go in your favor. So how do we identify now, this being the context, how do we identify unjust seizures using constitutional tools? There aren't many places you can look. The almost Freudianly named United States v. Ursary, not usury, does indicate that in rem civil forfeitures are not punishment for the purposes of the Double Jeopardy Clause to the Fifth Amendment. So that clause is out. But Justice Thomas provides one possibility in a case, United States v. Bajikajian from 1998. In that case, the gentleman did actually violate the law by attempting to leave the United States with a wad of cash well over the reporting requirements. So the case isn't exactly on point. But when the government tried to seize all $350,000 from Josep Krikor Bajikajian that he had intended to use to pay a debt, the district court found that the forfeiture grossly was disproportionate to the offense and therefore in violation of the excessive fines clause to the Eighth Amendment. The excessive fines clause is not a great place to find judicial review of civil forfeiture, but it's a start. But I would rather suggest that Bennis might be wrong and that there might be a 14th Amendment right to an innocent owner defense applicable at all levels of government. Certainly in civil context, no matter how the government permanently obtains property, it seems to me that it represents a taking to which just compensation would be requisite under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. And we can argue over other requisite natural aspects of due process, such as necessary burden of proof, etc., but I'll leave it there. The last thing I'd like to mention before I hand it over to Darpana are additional resources for folks that might be interested in the subject. One is Roger Pilon's testimony at the House Committee on the Judiciary prior to, you know, the passage of CAFRA in 2000. Another one is a recent New Yorker article taken by Sarah Stillman. It was a great article that listed a lot of sort of cases that shock the conscience. It's in the New Yorker. And I would also commend you to IJ's website, which I'm sure, again, Darpana will mention, but I will turn it over to Darpana now. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrew, and thank you, Dean, for hosting this great program on such an important topic. Before I get to sort of the legal technicalities and constitutional issues involved in civil forfeiture, I wanted to also share with you a couple stories basically that show the impact of forfeiture abuse on ordinary Americans and why this really matters. Andrew had mentioned the Deccos, who had owned the grocery store in Fraser, Michigan. IJ also represented a family-run motel. Russ and Patricia Caswell own a budget motel just inside the I-495 loop in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. This motel kind of provides a no-frills accommodations, just like the Motel 6 down the street from the hotel. But over the past 20 years or so, there were a tiny percentage of its guests who had been arrested for committing drug crimes while staying at the motel. Similar arrests were made at other local businesses, including the Motel 6, as well as in the parking lot of a nearby Walmart. There was no allegation that the Caswells or any of their employees had committed any crime or were involved in the drug activity, but the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts singled out this property. It was mortgage-free and worth $1.5 million for civil forfeiture. It took the Caswells more than 5 years before they had their day in court, and with the help of IJ, they were able to finally defeat the forfeiture action. These horror stories are not unusual in terms of the frequency with which they occur. They are unusual, however, in actually people being able to get their property back. I'll give a happy postscript to the story of the Deccos that Andrew had mentioned. Just recently, the government had voluntarily dismissed the action. With IJ's intervention, they decided to dismiss the case. So at least now the Deccos do have their money back, about $35,000. Unfortunately, if they had received a prompt hearing, they would have gotten their money back more than 10 months ago. But without their opportunity to sort of challenge the forfeiture, it was very difficult, and they endured this 10-month-long hardship. So welcome to the upside-down world of civil forfeiture. As you can tell maybe from these stories, there are a number of things wrong with civil forfeiture. Most obviously is that it's civil. As Andrew mentioned, in distinguishing between criminal forfeiture, there's no conviction or even arrest is required for the government to take your property. However, no one should lose their property without being convicted of a crime. In civil forfeiture, the government has a very low burden of proof to show that property is subject to forfeiture. A second problem with forfeiture laws is that where there are at least forfeiture laws that provide an innocent owner defense, it reverses the presumption of innocence. And this has been a hallmark of the American justice system. Instead of being presumed innocent until proven guilty, property owners are required to go into court and prove their innocence before being able to get their property back. Significantly, as the DECO's case show, there's also a lack of a prompt hearing requirement in most forfeiture laws. Although the federal forfeiture laws provide for a prompt hearing for tangible property, for cash or currency, there is no such prompt hearing, and many state laws follow the same model. Without any opportunity between the time your property is taken until the eventual civil forfeiture trial to contest the seizure of your property. So this can mean that you wait months or even years before you have your day in court, and in that time you are deprived of your property, whether it's your car or money or your home. Perhaps most significantly, though, and that's what I will address most of my comments about today, is that, as Andrew mentioned, civil forfeiture laws create what IJ calls policing for profit. And this is in stark contrast to the earlier forfeiture laws. In contrast to forfeiture laws, the historical predecessors, essentially, under modern civil forfeiture laws, law enforcement officials get to retain forfeiture proceeds for their own use. And this creates a direct financial incentive to seize property. And there are a number of problems with this, two constitutional problems at least. First is that it does create a due process problem. You have the same Department of Justice that's prosecuting Americans or taking their property under civil forfeiture gets to keep that property and decide how to either use it or spend the proceeds from its sale. Today's Asset Forfeiture Fund, which is just the largest of the federal government's forfeiture revenue sources, is over $4 billion. A second problem with this policing for profit, a constitutional problem, is that it violates the separation of powers. George Mason had warned about the dangers of having the same men hold both the sword and the purse. And this is exactly what modern civil forfeiture laws allow. And this is not just a theoretical problem. I think some of our listeners might be familiar with the purchase of the Thompson Prison in Illinois, and that's just the most recent example. Congress had objected to the purchase of this prison by the Obama administration because they believed it was going to house Guantanamo detainees. But the administration essentially vetoed that, or did an end run around congressional objections by using asset forfeiture funds and indicating that they would use asset forfeiture funds to make this purchase. So without congressional oversight or legislative oversight, members of law enforcement or the executive branch can often just spend the forfeiture proceeds without any accountability to the public or to the legislatures. And this often leads to a lack of transparency as to what's going on, especially at the state and local level, which often have poor or no reporting requirements on how forfeiture funds are spent. There's a myriad examples of just abuse stories. For example, Michigan police had spent, or one Michigan police officer had spent about $7,000 on a tanning salon for his wife and over $40,000 on drugs, prostitutes, and alcohol. There was a Massachusetts police officer who spent $1,000 on a Zamboni machine. And it's important to know that it's not just, random cases of bad apples in law enforcement, but because this profit incentive is so deep and it's perverse, it's a systemic problem. And it kind of ties back to, the lack of oversight. So a lot of times police departments or law enforcement officials can make questionable purchases where the legislature might not agree with. One related aspect is sort of this increased militarization of the police force. In North Carolina, for example, which does not allow civil forfeiture, police officers used forfeiture proceeds obtained from the federal government to purchase drones. Or there's another example of Missouri police officers spending $200,000 to purchase an armored personnel carrier. And these are important decisions that should not be made just by law enforcement officials alone. They should be subject to congressional oversight. Another constitutional problem with the profit incentive is at the federal level. Under federal forfeiture laws, state and local law enforcement can refer forfeitures to federal authorities and receive up to 80% of the proceeds. This program, known as equitable sharing, is really nothing more than legalized bounty hunting. Members of the Federalist Society especially appreciate the 10th Amendment problem that this equitable sharing loophole creates. Even when a state's law provides greater protections for property, state and local law enforcement can simply circumvent those laws and refer forfeitures to the federal government. So, for example, as I mentioned, North Carolina, which does not allow civil forfeiture and only provides for criminal forfeiture, through equitable sharing, law enforcement officials in North Carolina have received an average of more than $10 million a year in forfeiture proceeds. So these are just some of the main issues with civil forfeiture, and it's really become unmoored from it, from their original justifications that were envisioned by the founding generation. Just by way of concluding, if you are interested in learning more, I definitely commend you to IJ's website, www.ij.org. We've published a number of strategic research reports on the issue, including a comprehensive survey of state forfeiture laws where you can see where your state ranks. We also have some specific state reports on Georgia, Minnesota, Arizona, as well as a comprehensive report on the federal equitable sharing program. And with that, I'll turn it back to Dean.
Very good. Well, let's check in with the audience. We've got quite a few people on the line. We'll open the floor to your questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or perhaps both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have one caller with a question, and after that our lines are open. So again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. You guys are litigators and inclined to find solutions in litigation, but I've been working on this issue for a number of years, and I don't see a good solution that doesn't involve legislation. So we're simply going to have to get those statutes repealed. The problem is that they are backed by a very powerful interest group, as law enforcement officers have become. They're also, by the way, the main driving interest group behind gun control. And unless we can rein them in by making it unprofitable for them to commit these abuses, we're never going to really get ahead of this. It's always going to be playing defense.
Sure.
So unless the people who now profit from it have to pay a penalty if they get it wrong, and I mean not just their departments, but their themselves individually, we're not going to see the balance shifting in the right direction.
Sure.
Which really means we have to attack official immunity.
I think that there are a number of very good points in there. First of all, I am not a litigator. I have been in a previous life, but not here at Heritage. At Heritage, one of the things that I do is I am managing our civil justice reform initiatives, and as a part of that, we go state to state, and we work with state legislatures and try to educate folks to as to issues involving reform of our civil justice system. And I can tell you right off the bat that you're exactly right about the interest group issues here. I'm not going to name names, but there have been several states where proposals, serious proposals, backed by with bipartisan support to reform, to either prevent some sort of equitable sharing or to move the pot around or to curtail civil forfeiture on the merits at all. Several of these proposals have been scuttled by pushback from state police organizations. Now, there are good reasons why they should be behind these efforts as well. I mean, it certainly damages their prestige when you hear stories of selective enforcement, when they will refuse, you know, near the border where there are jurisdictions where state troopers will know that there are drugs being trafficked north and cash being trafficked south, so they only check the southbound traffic because they're more interested or might be more interested in seizing the cash and keeping it for themselves than drugs, which obviously they can't keep or use. So it certainly destroys the prestige, but that's, you know, it's a collective action problem. Another issue that you brought up was one response I would like to have. Well, I'll leave it to Darpana actually now, if you have any comments.
Oh, sure, sure.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I think, you know, the Institute for Justice definitely challenges these laws in the courtroom as well as the court of the public opinion, but we're also involved in legislative reform, and that is an important tool to curb the abuses from forfeiture. Right now, there are a number of legislative efforts in the works, both at the state and local level, as well as at the federal government. You know, CAFRA was an important reform back in the 1990s, but it really failed to address one of the most significant problems, which is, as you identified, the profit incentive. And so really, we do need to eliminate the profit incentive and require that forfeiture proceeds go back to a general fund or general revenue fund or a victim's fund instead of going directly back into law enforcement coffers. And that is how the law used to be back before the 1984 amendments. And additionally, we would need to eliminate through the legislative process how equitable sharing proceeds are distributed. We need to eliminate this equitable sharing loophole and make sure that when states choose to enact tougher protections to protect property rights, that the federal government doesn't get to come in and sort of veto those rights. IJ is involved also at the state level in Arizona, Georgia, Minnesota, Texas, and Maryland, and also the District of Columbia in involving forfeiture reform efforts. On our website, we have three publications which address, you know, the significant issues in Arizona, Georgia, and Minnesota. One great area for reform, and it may be that's more feasible, is to just institute reporting requirements at state and local as well as federal level, because the more people are aware and the more transparency there is in between how forfeiture proceeds are spent, the less abuse there might be. And that's just one small incremental step that could be accomplished through legislative reform. I'm also a member of the working group that's involved in reforming the District of Columbia's forfeiture laws, and we've made substantial progress there. So stay tuned for more developments on that end.
If I could add one more point, there was one more point to that question, which was qualified immunity. Just very briefly, for example, I brought up the Detroit case where a judge threw out the seizures of all the cars at Funk Night as violating the Fourth Amendment. To the extent that we get that these abuses that IJ continues to litigate, and they do great work, and other folks continue to fight back in courts, we do create a body of law that makes it very hard for self-dealing to be anything but laughed at. And the more cases like this, the more it becomes the standard practice that you have to kind of be on the up and up when you're doing civil seizures. So QI is very hard to pierce, but the more these things get litigated, the harder it is for abuses to occur.
Once again, we're speaking with Rapana Sheth and Andrew Kloster about civil asset forfeiture. Our lines are open, completely open right now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. You can get your question in now. While we're waiting to see who else might ring in with a question, let me remind folks that the National Lawyers Convention video, including the Clarence Thomas interview with Judge Diane Sykes, is available on the Federalist Society's website. We have a couple of telephone conference calls coming up that I'd like to announce. It's quite likely, although not yet certain, that we'll have a call tomorrow at 3 p.m. looking at patent reform legislation, which is now making its way pretty briskly through Congress. And that's likely to be, although I said not certain, tomorrow at 3 p.m. It will include Richard Epstein and a couple other commenters on the patent reform legislation. On Friday, we'll talk about what, if anything, might be behind the settlement in the Mount Holly disparate impact case that's garnered some news attention recently. You might remember it's the disparate impact case actually slated for argument in the Supreme Court and then settled, so it won't be decided by the Supreme Court. Once again, let me make another call for questions. Our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your phone if you'd like to ask either or even both of our experts a question. And while we're waiting, let me ask a question of either or both of you. What is the extent, you've given us some anecdotes and you've described the problem as existing at the local and the state and the federal levels. If you could strike, clear up the problem completely at one of those levels, which would you take if you could magically, wave a wand? That is, which is the worst offender? Is it the combined local authorities or the state authorities or the federal authorities?
Well, I would say it's a tough call, but I think the federal laws make it really, really tough. At the federal level, there are over 400 federal statutes that provide for forfeiture. And first of all, the amount of money they collect through forfeiture is just astronomical. It's been increasing exponentially. As I mentioned, it's over $4 billion, and it continues to grow. And I see, similar to after the Comprehensive Crime Control Act was passed in the 1980s, and there was this war on drugs, with a renewed effort to pursue forfeiture for drug activity, there is now an ongoing renewed effort to use civil forfeiture laws for what are deemed financial crimes. But just like the 1980 push did not really, result in getting drug kingpins so much as, the lower level ground kind of people on the ground or innocent owners, I think the same thing is happening here with the financial push. And that story of the DECOs kind of exemplifies that. And also because the federal government has this equitable sharing program, whatever reforms you do enact at the state or local level can be circumvented. So until that equitable sharing loophole is addressed, whatever reforms are enacted by state entities kind of can be circumvented. So I think that's the real area to focus on reform.
If I haven't been muted, perhaps I could follow up here.
John Rowland, before you do, let me give Andrew Kloster a chance to weigh in on that same question, okay, and then we'll come back to you, John.
That's quite all right. We can.
Okay. John Rowland, go right ahead.
Yeah, there's a more fundamental problem that isn't often addressed, which is the kind of jurisdiction involved here. It is sometimes said that there are three jurisdictions, in locum, personam, and subjectum. But what we have here is a fourth, which is a problem in that paradigm, the in rem jurisdiction. Now, originally, in rem was developed for property that had no apparent owner, such as booty, seized from pirates. They couldn't identify who the ultimate owners were. However, what is needed is to eliminate in rem jurisdiction or proceedings altogether, where the object is named as the party, and recognize that only a person can be a party to a legal proceeding, and that for any property, there has to be a presumptive owner, even if that is not known. So it could be style that John Doe, owner of.
Yes. I think that that is exactly the type of you seem in agreement with Justice Holmes. I quoted his book from 1881, The Common Law, where he talks about in rem or any proceeding against a thing as being sort of irrational. And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, because there are cases where seizures and certainly criminal forfeitures matter, and you can't necessarily get your hands on maybe a person skipped town, but he's still got a whole bunch of property here. There are times where a court actually does not really have jurisdiction over a body, but they do have jurisdiction over a thing. And there are times where certain physical objects are considered to be nuisances or things that should be seized for their very existence, contraband, drugs, you know, certain chemicals and things like that are seized. There are legal proceedings taken against them, and abandoned property. There is a place in our legal system, I think, even today, for in rem actions. But the issue with civil forfeiture, I think, and Darpana may have different views, the issue with civil forfeiture is, number one, its effect on its due process effect on folks that would like to contest, have good reasons to contest, but don't have the resources to contest or are being kept from contesting due to administrative wrangling. I think number two, the fact that, as Darpana mentioned, there are myriad statutes that authorize civil forfeiture in so many contexts, and it's very hard to keep track of. On the subject matter, it's just all over the place. And I think number three, the profit motive. So if you can deal with those three, we don't necessarily need to upend sort of maybe the formal structure of our jurisdictional system.
And just to add to that, yeah, Mr. Roland, I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, the original justification for forfeiture laws was, one, you are taking contraband per se, and people do not have a property right in contraband per se, such as drugs or illegal property. But now we're expanding it. So at the time, for example, there were in rem proceedings because of admiralty or piracy laws, and it was virtually impossible for a court in the colonies or in the United States to gain jurisdiction over a vessel overseas, and instead, or over the owner of the vessel or the operator of the vessel overseas. But now, modern civil forfeiture laws, they're devoid of this sort of just jurisdictional hook. I mean, there's too often prosecutors bring both a criminal forfeiture action, which is in personam against the individual, as well as a civil forfeiture action, and only because a civil forfeiture action is easier. So there's no jurisdictional necessity to use civil forfeiture because the person and the property is already there in the jurisdiction. And so there has been this abuse of the legal fiction that the property is guilty of a crime. It should be very narrowly circumscribed to instances like piracy or admiralty law, where the property is not within the jurisdiction.
Well, I think we need to distinguish between having property in custody and having jurisdiction over it. You know, you can have a human being in custody without having personal jurisdiction over him. So that's a fine distinction that needs to be insisted upon. But even so, if we simply required the formality of saying, if we don't know the owner, John Doe, presumptive owner of property X, then the question would always be open. Well, we don't know who John Doe is yet, but we're going to try to find out before we do anything further on this matter. And that would even apply to inanimate objects, you know, that fall from the sky. So it's a fine point, but if it were established. By the way, we have Holmes' book on common law on our website, if anyone wants to read it. If we were to establish even this distinction, it might go a long way toward beginning to unravel the Gordian knot that has been erected here.
I actually have a question for Darpana. If you might flesh out a little bit your separation of powers argument, because it seems that is something that I actually haven't heard, and it seems, you know, a lot of the constitutional arguments are what rights do individuals have to contest forfeiture proceedings in their individual case. But your argument goes to a much broader question, which is the entire system problematic? And it seems that, at least in the case of the Federal Asset Forfeiture Fund, the misuse of the fund is a statutory question because the fund is authorized by Congress. It has a specific purpose. It's not an open-ended, this is not something that would necessarily violate separation of powers, but it seems that your argument against what happened in, you know, the Guantanamo case, what your argument against what happened was not so much a constitutional argument, but a statutory one, that this was not authorized under the, this was not something that was authorized to be paid out of that fund.
Well, I guess it's kind of twofold. The Congress did authorize the Department of Justice's Asset Forfeiture Fund, but, and now that was back in 1984, and now, since then, the Department of Justice, or the executive branch, is essentially free to spend it on whatever it wants. There's not a whole lot of limitations on what it can spend. So you're right. I think Congress does have a very easy fix for that problem. It could simply just revoke that authorization. Or, because it does control the purse strings, it can simply reallocate that money or reappropriate it. Say, you know, the $4 billion that's sitting in the DOJ Assets Forfeiture Fund should be reappropriated to, you know, whatever purposes it deems fit. From a constitutional point of view, though, if Congress is exercising its rights to say, no, the Department of Justice should not spend money on this project, you know, regardless of what it is, that's just the most recent example. There is an institutional injury there. Now, litigating that as a constitutional matter is a much difficult problem because, you know, as you might know, with issues of standing, you know, the institutional, the standing of legislatures to kind of raise problems like this is difficult. But, you know, that is one in which maybe the legislative solution would be quicker and more efficient.
I just see that as a bit of an uphill battle because if Congress wanted to, if they had really wanted to not fund Guantanamo, they could have easily passed some sort of law to say that no funds may be spent on Guantanamo. And the fact that they didn't do so indicates that they might have been trying to play both sides. And in that case, what the president did might have been, at least as a constitutional matter, not problematic. So.
Well, I think it's you know, that's a different kind of political animal with the Thompson prison example because a lot of the controversy was involving the Guantanamo issue, which people, of course, were divided on both sides of the aisle. But that you can imagine in which maybe Congress is, as a whole, says no. You know, it's not just a partisan issue, but in general, Congress does not want to spend these funds on a certain project, and they could have done that.
We've got another question from an audience member, so let's check in with our next audience member. If you want to add yourself to the queue here, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
This is Jack Park. Thanks a lot. On the separation of powers is a case I can't remember, but it was the old law school chestnut about the justice of the peace getting paid out of traffic fine proceeds.
Oh, right.
And the self-dealing there. Just a question. Some years ago, at when the House turned over, there was some interest in over-criminalization. Has there been any interest in the pertinent House committees limiting or otherwise looking at the use of forfeiture proceeds?
Yes. Yeah, so just to clarify, the case that you referred to, there's a line of cases from the Supreme Court that talk about when a prosecutor or judge is deciding a case, they cannot have a direct financial incentive or pecuniary interest in the outcome of that proceeding. And that's as opposed to a separation of powers issue, it's more a due process issue. Due process requires an impartial decision maker. And if the member the judge or the prosecutor has a vested direct financial interest, they are no longer impartial. And so that is a line of cases we plan to use to challenge, we have been using, I should say, to challenge forfeiture laws. On the over-criminalization side, there is a bipartisan House committee right now that's been authorized to look at over-criminalization issues, and we're in the midst of trying to raise awareness of the forfeiture and see whether they might address in some upcoming hearing about federal forfeiture and sort of raise awareness at that level or conduct hearings, even if it's not part of the over-criminalization task force, maybe just in another capacity.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Closter, do you have anything on this point?
No, I would just say that it doesn't seem like there's anything right now, but these sort of things do percolate up. It's not one thing I would stress is that it's a very tough issue. Civil forfeiture is very hard to explain to people easily, and it's very hard to explain to legislators easily, and it's very hard for them to explain to their constituents easily, and it's hard to use any of these examples and find out exactly how to fix the system. We think it's easy. I think Darpana and I, from this end, you look at it and you say, oh, gosh, we just don't let them do this sort of thing. But in terms of explaining it to people, getting them riled up, in terms of getting votes, in terms of allowing members of Congress to get their TV spots, it's just a very tough sell. So I encourage members folks that are listening right now to reach out to myself. If you have any thoughts on how to market these sorts of civil forfeiture, it's, I mean, even the name is just very long and kind of arduous. But when you hear these stories, when you hear, you know, folks went to a party and had their cars seized for something they had no involvement in, and then had to pay $900 for the privilege to get their car back, or family home taken from folks who went to a hearing and had no translator and they only spoke Spanish, and you know their house was seized because some, you know, friend of a friend of their nephew dealt drugs on the front yard. I mean, those are kind of stories that people understand, but it's just hard to explain the law to people, and it's hard to get movement in the legislature.
I'd disagree just a little bit there. I don't think it's hard to explain. I think it's just people aren't aware of these laws. I think if you tell most, you know, the average American that in this country, the government can take your property without convicting you of a crime and without compensating you for it, they would not believe you. They think, well, that's un-American. If you told most people in this country that you'd have to go to court and prove your innocence, they would say, what about the presumption of innocence? You know, what about innocent until proven guilty? I think the reason, you know, it sort of has the traction it does is simply because, one, there is a lack of awareness on the part of the average American of these laws until they've actually been affected by it. I think these forfeiture abuse stories do help, and the media attention that's recently been given to this issue is very helpful. You mentioned the New Yorker article taken, and there's been, you know, some pieces in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times and the Washington Post and The Economist even has covered about the DECO story, and that's certainly helpful. I think the real problem here is trying to combat or you know, go against the huge law enforcement lobby. There are a lot of vested interests here, and, you know, it makes it very simple. You know, I think the DOJ logo for the asset forfeiture funds, you know, taking the profit out of crime. Well, that intuitively makes sense until people can understand how it actually works. And so that's something that it's more, let's raise awareness of this issue and show how it's affecting people and then be able to combat the law enforcement lobby. I've yet to hear a good rationale for why law enforcement officials should get to keep the property or profit from the proceeds as opposed to having legislature or congressional oversight.
We've got about 10 more minutes left. One caller with a question pending. If we might have time for two more questions. If you want to join the line, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rollenbeck. One thing we might consider is, for example, to plant tips to law enforcement that would result in the seizure of the assets of, let's say, elected officials' campaign funds, or perhaps the assets of major donors. I think that those two groups have been considering themselves above the law, and if they started being targeted, just like the ordinary folks out here, that there might be some movement on this subject. And all it takes is an anonymous phone call to set the word, the process in motion.
I think while that may make some sense politically, I'm not going to say that I would wish this on anybody or anybody's campaign funds. I know that there's a little bit of perverse incentive for advocates as well, which is that without these terrible cases, you don't have stories or cases or clients, but you don't want the cases or clients or stories in the first place. It'd be a much more just and humane legal system if we were out of work on this issue, I think.
Rapana Sheth, do you want to weigh in on this point? Or?
No, I think people have a First Amendment right and with their politics to spend, you know, money as they'd like. And I think this issue, you know, people, regardless of who they are, private property is sacrosanct and should not be taken without a conviction.
Very good. It looks like we're out of questions from our audience. We've got a couple minutes left here. Let me see if our speakers want to express any final thoughts here. Why don't we go in the order we opened in? Andrew Kloster, final thought?
Well, I would just encourage people to educate themselves on the issue of civil forfeiture. Tell your friends and neighbors about these stories and just generally do some of the education work here. Because as Darpana mentioned, that's a huge issue. People are just not aware. And so I would again commend you to IJ's website. They do great work. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for having me.
Darpana Sheth.
Yes. You know, just by way of conclusion, I think civil forfeiture represents one of the greatest threats to private property and due process rights today. As one Pennsylvania state court judge had characterized it, civil forfeiture is nothing more than state-sanctioned theft, and we should do everything in our power, whether it's fighting in the courts or through the court of public opinion, as well as the to get legislative reform to overturn these laws. We do have more information at our website, as Andrew mentioned, and if you follow us on Facebook, IJ, or on our Twitter at IJ, and I'm also on Twitter at Darpana for more updates on forfeiture abuse.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank both Andrew Kloster of the Heritage Foundation, Darpana Sheth of the Institute for Justice. This has been a fascinating, if perhaps discouraging, discussion. To our audience, I invite you to check our website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.